This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week, we come to you from Trieste in Italy. Where's Trieste, you might ask? Well, I just gave you the coordinates, but the reason why we're here is to spend some time at the shipyard in Fincantieri in Monfalcone in Italy, where they're, like every other shipyard in the world, operating at 100% capacity. Believe it or not, every shipyard in the world is running full. 57 new cruise ships of every size and pedigree are being constructed. The industry is on the verge of a major explosion of new tonnage, as they like to call it. And we're here for one particular ceremony, which has some great historical significance if you're in the shipbuilding business. It's called the coin ceremony. I'll explain that in a little bit, with MSC Cruises. And if you haven't heard of MSC Cruises, you're not alone. In fact, it's surprising, since MSC Cruises is the world's fourth largest cruise line and the largest privately owned cruise company in the world. And in fact, if you add in all their other ships, they are huge. And they're building their biggest ship ever, and in fact, the biggest ship ever built at this shipyard, called Seaside. And what's the coin ceremony? It's a naval tradition going back hundreds of years, where before the ship is completed and after they've laid the keel, they insert a ceremonial coin inside the ship that, of course, will then sail with the ship forever. And that's what they're doing today. This ship will be coming online next year, quite a big ship it is. Lots of things to talk about that throughout this show, because it's not just MSC, it's the cruise industry worldwide and how things are changing. But consider this. Believe it or not, this company has 12 ships, and they're going now. And this is the thing that's staggering to me. Talk about a change in the world. They're going to more than 1,000 routes and ports around the globe. Another surprise, you may have heard the story already because we covered it, of the first U.S. cruise line, which is Carnival and their brand Fathom, to sail into Havana. Just happened a few days ago. And that's a big deal. It's the first U.S.-based cruise ship to sail into Havana in decades. And yet, surprise, surprise, here's MSC, a European-based cruise line that has had one of their ships home-ported in Cuba for quite some time now. So, you know, leave it to the Europeans to beat us every chance they get, and they just beat us again. But a whole different experience on MSC, because it's not the traditional 7-day U.S. cruise experience where, you know, everybody's there with the kids and it's Orlando and it's Disney and it's... No, this is a European experience. Different kind of food offerings, different kind of languages spoken, different kinds of music played on board. And if you're looking for a different kind of cruise experience, one that will be more culturally immersive, perhaps, this might be the way to go. But the real challenge right now for the entire cruise industry is, where are you going to go now? You know, with every ship being built already spoken for, with all the other ships that are coming online, where can you go that you haven't gone before that make it viable, that make it interesting, that make it safe, that preserves a truly authentic, genuine experience? And that's really the challenge, because if you take a look at river cruising, which has had explosive growth over the last 10 years and truly explosive growth in the last six, you know, at a certain point you run out of rivers. Or as we're seeing in certain parts of the world right now with drought conditions, you run out of water depth and the rivers aren't navigable. Now, that hasn't happened worldwide yet, but it's a concern. But with the cruise line industry, think about this. We did the show recently from the Mississippi River, and the American cruise lines doing the riverboat cruises. They're coming back on the Mississippi. How about the Columbia River? People forget that's a navigable river, and there's some great cruises there. But there's the Volga in Russia. There are rivers in China that have yet to be explored. There are rivers in Volga, seacoast in Africa, that once those countries get more stable, become viable ports. And you'll see that while the worst word that starts with F in the travel industry, fear, gets operated in terms of where cruise lines suddenly don't want to go when things happen, you'll see cruises basically opt to move out of Istanbul as a port call because of what happened with some recent terrorist activity. But you know what? They'll come back. And or maybe they'll go to another part of Turkey. Maybe they'll go to Antalya, or they'll go to Dalaman, or they'll go to Bodrum. The great opportunity now for people in who are thinking about taking a cruise, and the statistics, by the way, are staggering and surprising. How many people do you think have ever taken a cruise? Let me give you this statistic. This year, 1.2 billion, you heard me, billion people will cross an international border. How many Americans will cruise? About 23 million. That's a small, infinitesimal fraction of that 1.2 billion amount. So the opportunity for growth is, I won't say limitless, because that's where people get into trouble, but it's certainly substantial. So something to think about when looking at where you want to go. Do you want to take a 3 or 4 day introductory cruise, or do you want to get more bold and go to some places that are only really accessible by ship, or sometimes even by the smaller ships? All sorts of opportunities there. So stick around.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Joining me now at the shipyard, the CEO of MSC Cruises, Gianni Onorato. How are you, sir?
Very well. Thank you, Peter. Nice to be here.
And nice to have you here. You know, looking around the shipyard, if I didn't know any better, I would think that the economy has never been better in the world for anything, especially cruise ships. There was a time they weren't that busy. Now, every single shipyard in the world is operating at 100% capacity. At last count, 57 new ships of every size and pedigree are being built. The shipyards they can't build any more, and you've got a lot of them as well.
Oh, yes, definitely. That's a very nice moment. It's a moment where it's a very euphoric moment for the cruise industry. We are building, for example, at MSC, 11 new ships in the next 10 years. So we have, let's say, ships ordered until 2026. So it's really a very nice moment. And so new ships are coming in the market. So this means that it's a very exciting moment.
It's a very exciting moment if you happen to own a shipyard, too, because you're just guaranteed work for all of your people and profits for 15 to 20 years.
Of course, the three yards that today really are ruling, let's say, the shipbuilding business worldwide, in Italy, in France, and in Germany. But it's also an opportunity to create jobs, additional jobs in these countries, and not only because there is all of a surrounding network of people coming from all over the world who are participating to a construction of a ship.
Now, there's euphoria, but is it backed by common sense? Some people would say, oh, my God, you're building so many ships, you're going to have excess capacity. You say no.
Definitely not. Otherwise, we would be crazy on building all the ships. We do think that the cruise as a type of holiday is very underpenetrated in most of the worldwide markets.
Give me an idea of the percentage, because when we were talking before the show, you gave me some numbers that were actually surprisingly low.
There are only 23 million guests traveling on a cruise every year in the world, which 30 million are North Americans and only 6.5 are Europeans. And now a portion of approximately 1.5 million are going to be Chinese. So it's a very, very low number if you consider the population and the number of holiday packages that are sold around the world in 1 year.
Well, putting that in perspective, we're talking about 130 million Chinese people that'll be traveling, this burgeoning middle class, and only 1.5 million maybe on a cruise. That's nothing.
Definitely. That's what this confirms what I was saying of the low penetration. And then if we add on it that the high value for money and also the excitement of living totally a new type of holiday, this makes the cruise industry a very, very solid industry for the next 25 years.
You know, there was a time not too long ago where you thought of a cruise as the Eastern Med, the Western Med, Eastern Caribbean, the Western Caribbean, Alaska, and then every once in a while, one of the cruise lines would do an around-the-world cruise or one of their world voyages. Now we're talking about over 1,000 ports. That's staggering.
In five continents. So all the five continents of the world are part of this development. I mean, only MSC, which today is only 12 ships. We're already calling South Africa. We're calling South America, we're calling Caribbean, we're calling Mediterranean, we're calling Northern Europe, we're calling Middle East, Dubai and Abu Dhabi, we're calling China and Asia. So there is really a wide range and a wide array of ports available for cruising.
And while every other cruise line is lining up to go to Cuba, for at least the European market, you were there first.
Yeah, we were the first, and we're very excited on that because we have started with one ship last year, and we're going to double next winter. Actually, we are going to have a ship staying there year-round.
As a home-ported ship?
Absolutely. We have airlifts, flights coming from all over Europe and Canada, which are taking every week 4,500 people.
So you're filling the ships?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very appealing destination, and on the top of it, Caribbean overall still remains a very appealing, attracting destination.
And for guys who got in first to Cuba, you had to learn all your lessons ahead of everybody else. What's the biggest lesson you learned about dealing with Cuba?
That you find a lot of professional people there as a part of the supply chain that you need to manage a ship. At the same time, that there is a berthing
challenge.
A berthing challenge, because also bigger ships cannot berth there yet, and so that a lot needs to do in terms of infrastructure.
In terms of logistics and just supplying the ships, I mean, I always find that so fascinating about how you basically provide and provision your ships. You know, how many steaks are you boarding on board? How many cases of beer? How many potatoes? I mean, it gets pretty down to crazy stuff, you know? How many bottles of vodka versus how many bottles of rum? Are you boarding anything in Cuba?
Yes, mainly we do.
Rum?
Rum for sure and cigars for sure. But on the top of it, in this case, MSC is a much easier life. Because and the biggest business of MSC shipping is to be the second largest container carrier in the world. So, I mean, we have a good planning and we have a lot of provisions also coming from the other parts of the world.
So you're supplying yourself.
Absolutely. And that's what
you
we call,
figured it out.
That's what we call synergy.
Now, one of the reasons why we're here is because you have a new ship at the yard that you're building now, and there's a coin ceremony. What is that?
It's a very, how can I say, it's a very old tradition in the seafaring industry that practically there are these two coins, one from the yard and one from the ship owner, which are practically inserted into the steel of the ship, and they will stay there for the rest of the life.
You put the coins in, there's a ceremony, and then the whole ship is built around it.
Absolutely, and there are also two godmothers. One is representing the yard, one is representing the cruise line. And so again, the signature of these two godmothers will stay with the ship for the rest of the life of the ship.
What's special about the coins themselves?
The coins themselves, which is, first of all, the golden coins. which is already important. And then it's also a tradition which makes it in a way that is already a piece of something precious that the ship is getting. It's the first precious gift that the ship has, which will keep forever with her.
Stupid question, but I got to ask it. At the end of the life of a ship, when they're breaking the ship apart, where's the coin go?
You know, I've never broken a ship, so I don't know.
I would love to find. Somebody at the shipyard's going to have to tell me that story, because everybody knows it's in there. Somebody's going to have to want that coin.
I think that they will be taken away before the ship is taken to scrap. I'm sure.
Well, you'll be the guy to do it.
In 30 years' time, 40 years, I will tell you.
But not every cruise line does the coin ceremony.
It's a matter of how traditional you are. In our case, our company was born from a family of seafarers, old 300 years. So obviously, this is a tradition which is passing during the course of the family or during generations. Then there are other cruise lines probably which are either younger or they are not really have a strong seafaring tradition or more in the a leisure tradition than a seafaring tradition. So probably they believe that this is not necessary.
But MSC is really family-owned when you think about it.
It's the only private family-owned company. It's the largest cruise line, private family-owned. And at the same time, it's a company which is owned by the Aponte family, and what they do is only ship business in shipping
and coin manufacturing, at least for two of them.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
I love visiting shipyards, especially now because they're so busy. They've never been busier, at least in my recent history. 57 different cruise ships being built of every size and pedigree. And my next guest is building the most number of them. He's got 12 on order. His name is Vago Pier Francesco.
Yes. By the way, when I was young, by the time they called me Pier Francesco, the family, I was gone. So by the time they say Pier Francesco,
now it's just Vago.
I was gone. No, they gave me a nickname, which is Kiko.
Okay, Kiko.
So it's like
now
a dog. Like
now
Kiko.
Okay, Kiko.
Sit. You know, you don't have to run away.
You're the executive chairman of MSC yes. Cruises. You have, I mean, there are a lot of ships being ordered. You got 12 on order.
Yes. Yes, Peter, we have to look at the future. We know that there are only three shipyards that can build such complex ships in the world. So we got to have not only an industrial plan well in mind, but we got to foresee what the future will be. So we are, the numbers speaks for themselves. Today, the cruise industry, which is no longer cruise per se, but it's a type of a vacation. The numbers are 25 million globally, so the potential is there. And if it takes so long, and if it takes only three shipyards to build such ships, we got a plan, and we got to have a good plan ahead.
And this particular shipyard is quite historic. I mean, they built everything from submarines to container ships. They built everything, and now they are building the biggest ship they've ever built, which is yours.
Yes, 155,000 gross tonnage, 323 meters long.
So that's almost 1,000 feet.
Yes, yes, indeed. If we think that the biggest ship only up to 15 years ago were 40,000, so we're talking about three times bigger, it's considerable.
Almost four times bigger.
Yeah, four times bigger. Yeah. So it's quite a ship.
MSC is a line that's well known. It's a young line as a cruise line, right? Only how many years old?
Well, I became CEO of MSC in 2003. So
13 years.
13 years, and we grew by 800%.
And yet, you're not a new company.
That's it.
How many hundreds of years do you go back?
Well, the tradition, we are still a family business, and the tradition of the family goes back 300 years. So we are actually the second largest shipping line in the world.
And all family owned.
All family owned. And we run in the excess of 500 ships. And I'm sure many of you must have seen those yellow boxes with that funny black logo in the middle, and that is an MSC container.
And there are a lot of those containers out there.
Yeah, many. There are in excess of 5 million boxes around the world.
your brand is well known in Europe. You concentrated on that, and now you're getting some of your ships ready to go other places, including more coming to the U.S.
We are very well known also in North America. As a matter of fact, we are the largest shipping line, commercial shipping line in North America.
But as a cruise line.
As a cruise line, first of all, we kept the brand, the logo of the industrial cousin,
sure.
Which is already quite a decision on our side, you know, because we sell in dreams, we sell in holidays. So the fact that we keep an industrial brand is also to show the tradition, the knowledge, the know-how, the history that you just mentioned in knowing how to run a shipping company. We're getting to know the consumer because, of course, we enter the hospitality, and we did it in a very strong way with the 12 new ships that we built since 2003, and we grew by 800%, so quite an important number. And this year we will host in excess of 1.7 million passengers. Of course, the growth, like you correctly pointed out, was in Europe. Now we bring in our European family, savoir-faire, flair, Mediterranean diet.
There's no such thing as a Mediterranean diet. I've seen the ships. I've seen the food on those ships. You're going to weigh more when you leave.
Indeed.
Yeah, you know you are.
There is a lot of food, a lot of eating going on.
Yeah. Pasta on the port side, pasta on the starboard side.
And mozzarella in the middle.
There, now we're cooking. But the American market is an interesting market for you because are they ready for your style of cruising?
Well, Peter, I think, first of all, we are very particular in the sense that we run and control the product, not only the building of the hardware, but even the software. We control the whole product from A to Z with MSC people, with our employees. So this
You're not outsourcing.
We don't outsource nothing, not even the shops, not even the spa. So everything is fine-tuned within our personnel, with our standards. And that allows us to, yes, have a common denominator, which is the Mediterranean hospitality, but to really adapt to the area where we operate. That means that when we come to North America, of course we're going to North Americanize our product, our experience. Of course we understand what is at stake. Of course we understand certain peculiarities that the market requires. But, the entertainment, which is very important, the five-star hotel, quality of the food, the choice, and of course the hardware. You know, we have an attention to details that I don't think many of our peers can actually see.
And who picks that out?
Well, that's the sore point because,
it's the truth now. Who picks it out?
My mother-in-law.
And she's the boss.
Yeah, and she's the boss. So how
you get beaten up for the budget, she does what she wants to do.
So I imagine to run a big corporation, have budgets and deliver dividends every quarter, and have your mother-in-law that comes in and say, I like that, I want that, no matter how much it costs.
What's the one thing she wanted? You said, are you kidding? And she says, no, and you put it in. What was the one thing that still stands
out? Well, actually a pavement made out of gold leaves. Actually, on the Divina, she sails out of Miami every Saturday. So, you can go there and see for yourself. At the entrance of the theater, we actually have this pavement that is made of gold leaves. And you can't believe not only the expense, of course, it goes without saying, but how long it took to outlay these very thin layers of gold leaves.
Just because she wanted it.
And because the color was matching and the sensation and the experience and the wow effect before entering the Broadway theater.
Did you have any say at all in that? You just had to do it.
Well, I tried to have my say, but mothers-in-laws are.
Does it have a name now?
No. I try not to keep name. I want to brand different things because otherwise I'll have to repeat them.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go.
We've been talking to Kiko Vago Pierfrancesco, the chief executive. I can never get the titles right. Executive chairman.
Yeah, executive chairman.
You'll live with that, right?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Of MSC Cruises. Earlier today, while we were watching here, watching a shipyard at work is just amazing because it's not just one ship being built. It's just movement everywhere you look. How many people actually work here?
Well, today in the yard, we have in excess of 6,000 people, 6,000 workers.
Right.
So it's quite impressive. The yard is full.
It is
so
totally
there
full.
Is many blocks. So what is a yard? A yard is an assembler. So they work the steel, they bend the steel, they weld the steel. So what you see is blocks of in the region of 2,500 tons that are put together. They're outfitted with tubing piping, and they're actually mounted together in a dry dock. And then that's the first stage. And then eventually there is a lot of work being given to the outside territory, to the suppliers, sub-suppliers, which actually come in and they provide all the outfittings, the interior decorating, the machinery, the technology.
And it has and to be gets, done, and it has to be done in sequence.
Yeah, all in sequence. So there is a big planning, there is timing, there is engineering, so quite a complex.
From the time you conceive the ship, from the actual concept to the design, to the actual construction, to the actual floating out, we're talking 2.5 to 3 years at least?
Well, to design a prototype, which are not so many because it's very difficult to find the right equilibriums of ratios of public spaces, privacy, enjoyment, flow of the passengers, the cabins. Very complex exercise. It takes more or less 12 months to design a new prototype, a new platform.
And if you come up with one you like?
And once you go give the go-ahead, then it will take 36 months to actually build the ship.
Listen, once you give the go-ahead, you're stuck with it whether you like it or not.
Yeah. Once you're committed,
So this ship that we're looking at today, right, the Seaside, is going to come on the market November of next year?
November 17.
Right.
And she'll be sailing out of Miami. And she's an amazing ship. I mean, she's a new design, new prototype, futuristic. Imagine that, Peter. You know, when we design a ship, we have to think of a ship that will be delivered in 5 years' time. So it's a ship
and that will last for at least 20.
At least 30. That's
excuse
how we amortize.
Me.
Yeah. So imagine that we design something that will have to be actual in 10 years' time. So we design in something that will be delivered in 2020, and in 2030, we'll actually have to satisfy the requirement, the needs of our clients.
That's a little bit of a gamble.
Well, it's not a gamble. You got to have vision. You got to understand that technology, entertainment, the food experience, you got to envision what the future will be and what people will want in this type of holiday. And that's an exciting...
Okay, so in designing the Seaside, what were some of the features you said, you know what, this is going to endure because it's got X? What's X?
Well, not only the made in Italy, the design, she's a new looking ship. You know, I want a ship that when you drive down that Miami Beach, you know, Ocean Drive, I mean, you look, you turn your head and you say, wow, what was that? You know, and I think we
that's
saw
the ship with all the gold leaf.
No, the gold leaves are inside.
Oh, wait. She didn't get a chance to do that on the other
ships?
No. What if she's listening to the show? You got a problem.
You put him in trouble.
I know,
Peter.
Okay.
But also she's, we call the ship that will follow the sun because she's got very generous space, public spaces in outside. So it means that you can enjoy not only your chaise lounge, you know, your chair and sit outside and spend the whole day there if you want, but there will also be the peculiarity, the novelty to actually have a public spaces inside that go outside. So you can actually have a drink, you can eat at the restaurant, be inside. Inside and being outside, very important with the comfort class. That means that you can sit outside, be on what we call this deck, this outside deck that we call Nalai, close to the sea, which is very well protected. So you can have a drink.
You're not going to be blown away.
And you're not going to get blown away. And that is so important. A new experience. You enjoy nature.
Now you're also building an island.
Yes. So we wanted to give the natural extension to the ship. So we found this industrial site in the Bahamas.
And by the way, other cruise lines, in due respect, they have their own private islands too, but this is a little different.
This is very different, not only because it's an industrial island. In fact, it was created. Somehow it was an old island that was utilized for dredging argonite, which is sand, this beautiful sand of the Bahamas. So in the 60s, what they did, they actually dig the channel through the reef. So you can actually enter this island and you can go with the ship, with such a big ship, 1,000 feet long. You actually sail through, enter the reef and go alongside to the island. So the island and the ship will be an extension of one another. You know, you can enjoy the ship and the island together. And the design and the facilities that we put and the meters, again, the space, the beaches is so important.
Well, you call it a marine reserve.
Yes, Marine Reserve, because that's another thing to us that it's very important. You know, Peter, we live for the sea, we live by the sea. The sea is our life, so we have a great respect for the sea. The sea is our future. So you know how environmentally, how important it is that we respect the sea, and that's the sign and the present that we want to give to the government of the Bahamas to turn this site into a marine reserve where we'll rebuild the reef, where we repopulate the fish, so it will be an amazing job.
Now, you talk about the traditions of your family and as seafarers. That very much involves even how you operate your ships today. For example, there are certain traditions, like you don't want to sail on a Tuesday or a Friday, right?
Yes, you know, tradition for us is very important in the marine.
Is it tradition or superstition?
Well, there is a little bit of both. Yeah. It's borderline. So it's true. We don't start on a Tuesday. We don't sign a contract. We don't start any new activity on a Tuesday, not on the Friday. And everybody knows that MSC never try to get a contract signed on a Tuesday and a Friday
in Geneva
because it won't happen.
So if you have a ship in port and it's supposed to sail on a Tuesday night, you wait until 1 minute after midnight?
Exactly. And then we sail.
Oh, my God. Now, the other tradition we just saw today, the coin ceremony.
Yes.
Explain the coin ceremony.
The coin ceremony goes back to the Roman times. In those days, the tradition was that you used to put between the mast and the keel the coin, and it was a sign of a pagan a ritual, you know, to wish good luck, to give good wind to the ship.
And it stayed on the ship for the entire life of the ship, of
exactly,
course.
Until the ship eventually was dismantled and the coin was recuperated. So we still have that tradition 5,000 years later, you know, from the Phoenicians and the Romans till today.
Does the coin ever come back?
No, because the ships are all brand new, so we got a long way to go before we even think about that. So,
but it's a tradition that you still maintain. Not every cruise line does that.
No, we have some important moments during the construction of the ship. The first is the keel laying. Sorry, the first one is the steel cutting, which is the initial cutting of the steel. You know that signifies the beginning of the construction of the ship. The second one is the coin ceremony, which is really the keel laying. So the keel goes into the dry dock.
Right. And the third one is those coins were put in today.
Yeah.
And they were covered. They were welded shut.
That's
right?
it.
And now the ship gets built around it.
That's it. So now the blocks will be mounted. And the next big important moment will be the floating, when the ship will be put together, assembled, and then it will actually be, it will move into a wet dock.
I have to tell you, coming here to a shipyard and seeing the amount of steel that goes into one of those ships, I could not possibly imagine how it would ever float, but they do.
And technology. There is a lot of technology. These babies cost in the excess of $1 billion nowadays. So the latest technology goes into this piece of machinery. So.
Oh, by the way, I just got a phone call from your mother-in-law. There's some gold leaf being delivered to this ship. You better get out there right away.
Hello? This is your captain speaking. There is absolutely no cause for alarm.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure.
The third season of Peter Greenberg's public television series, The Travel Detective, premieres this month. And as in every season, the program was shot all over the world, giving you critical, essential information about everything from understanding frequent flyer miles to how the best tour operators train their guides. While we gear up for season 3, we invite you to go to www.trafalgarcontest.com and enter to win the grand prize of a Trafalgar Europe vacation. Or you can always visit our website, petergreenberg.com, for more information.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
You know, I always like to ask a local where I'm going somewhere, but you don't necessarily expect to find someone from Racine, Wisconsin in Trieste. But guess what? Not only is there somebody from Racine, Wisconsin here, she's the president of the Italian-American Association of Trieste. Her name is Caroline Steckley. How are you?
I'm great.
Or I should say, how are you, A?
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to find other Americans here in Trieste. Wonderful.
Well, you've been here how long now?
I've been here for 13 years.
And how did you get here?
I got here because I met my husband, who's a Triestino, on a cruise ship.
Oh, no.
Yep.
What ship?
It wasn't the Titanic.
What ship was it?
It was the Zuiderdam, which was a...
Holland America,
yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. How many years ago was that?
Gosh, that was... Well, if that was December of 2002... And I was living here. I came on my birthday, June 17, 2003. I was married to him in August. So it was a whirlwind thing. We're still married. But now we have a 5-year-old daughter. So
basically, it's the love boat.
It really.
Really. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Or we call it the first CD of the Titanic. Like, don't put in the second one.
But the most amazing thing is it really happened on a cruise ship in the Med.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well, no, it wasn't here, actually. It was in the Caribbean.
Oh, excuse me. You were really. So basically, you were on vacation. On a cruise,
right,
minding your own business, and some guy from Trieste said, "Hello, Caroline."
Exactly. Oh. Terrible. No, it was, you know, the Trieste has Fincantieri, which builds a lot of these cruise ships. In fact, yes. The Zuiderdam was built by Fincantieri. And
so we've come full circle.
Really, exactly. And my husband was working for a company that, at that point, was responsible for the refrigeration on a lot of these cruise ships. And he was not supposed to be on the ship, but nobody else wanted to go because there was a problem and it was their fault. So he got convinced to go, but he said, well, it's Christmas, New Year's. I think I could go. Maybe I'll have some fun too.
So,
and there you go.
And then he broke the ice. Ha, 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 ha,
ha.
Yeah. Now, what did you know about Trieste?
Nothing.
Right. So you talk about a fish out of water. Did you speak Italian?
I didn't speak Italian. I knew it was close to Venice. I'd been to Venice before because I was an exchange student in Belgium when I was 18.
Of course you were.
And so I was...
And what did he know about Wisconsin?
Oh, nothing.
Of course.
Not many people know anything about Wisconsin.
I know Wisconsin.
Really. You do?
I'm a Badger. I went to school there in Madison.
Really?
You bet. I know about Wingspread.
Really?
Where is Wingspread?
Oh, gosh. Don't. If my mother's listening to this, she's going to kill me. Where is it?
Racine.
Oh, Wingspread. Okay. This like Frank Lloyd Wright thing, right?
Exactly. Okay. See, I gotcha.
Thanks.
See what happens when you move to Italy? You forget about Wisconsin.
I thought you were going to ask me difficult questions about Trieste. Instead, you asked me things about my own city that I can't answer. But I do love Wisconsin.
Me
and
too.
I'm a cheesehead at heart.
Me too.
And that never, never leaves.
Still a Packer fan?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. I don't follow them, but I love them.
How's the cheese here?
It's pretty good.
Now you really are a Wisconsin girl.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
What was the first thing that surprised you about Trieste? Because everything had to be a surprise. What was the one thing that just like bowled you over?
Well, I think the Piazza Unità bowled me over because...
Which is?
Which is the main square of the city. It's the largest one in Europe that has one wall of it, which is the sea. So that's the claim to fame here because we can't compare it to Piazza San Marco in Venice, which doesn't have... It's not directly on the sea. So that's how they say, well, we're a little bit better than them for that. So it's smaller, but it's really beautiful. And I think the architecture is surprising because you expect Trieste to be Italian, when in actuality it's more like Venice when you see it. The architecture is much more Austro-Hungarian because it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
And yet the beautiful thing is you wake up in the morning and you are really on the sea.
That's the most beautiful part. So even there are a few buses that give you the best view of the city. Even if you don't have a car like me, you've got the possibility to really see something
beautiful.
Okay,
so what bus do I take to get the best view?
The 42, the 44, the 46, which will take you up to Prosecco in the Carso.
See, you've already figured it out, haven't you? Yeah. Now, you're the president of the Italian-American Society. Was there an Italian-American Society before you got here?
Yes, there was. And I'm not the president, I'm the director.
Oh, excuse me.
You know, because the president's a great guy. He's a professor at the university who's more American than we are as far as films are concerned, Leonardo Bonomo. And the association has existed for, it'll be 55 years in November. It was started by the Americans after
World War II.
World War II during the Allied military government.
So obviously other Americans came here the way that you did, not by choice. They were sent here and they stayed.
Yeah,
they probably married Italian women.
Yeah, many of them did. And many of the American soldiers actually took them back to America. So there actually is a film series, one called the Ragazze di Trieste, which is about the Triestina women who went to America with their American husbands. And this was like 50 years later.
Wow.
And then our association, along with the American Embassy in Rome and the consulate in Milan, actually produced another film, which was the follow-up, which is American Presence in Trieste. So we're really proud of that. We did it last year.
All right, so got to ask the question. How big is the American presence in Trieste?
Well, at this point, we think there are maybe between 50 and 100 of us at any given time, or I should say that are more permanent. We also have a lot of researchers coming in. We've got people coming in on 2-year contracts for the different science institutes and international international school, et cetera. So there are lots more of us that we don't know, but we meet them and then they kind of come and go.
Something tells you that once they get here, you find out they're here.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger, Roger. What's our vector, Victor?
Now I radio clearance, over.
That's Clarence, over. Over.
Roger.
Huh?
All right, so you came here 13 years ago. You were immersed almost immediately in the culture and the history because you weren't on vacation. You moved here.
Yeah, which I thought it would be like vacation. But the first thing I found out after spending a little time with my little book at home, learning my grammar, was that...
What was the first word you learned?
Well, you know, come stai?
How are you?
Tutto bene. Problem was when I got here, people spoke to me. I felt very clever because I'd say, come stai? Oh, tutto bene. And then with my husband, come sei ciò? They speak a dialect here. And nobody told me that because I didn't realize that Italy has all these dialects. So that made me kind of doubly foreign. So I started
They knew right away.
So I learned the dialect too. That was something that was important and made me fit in a little bit better. At least when I didn't speak it, the fact that I could use some of the words made people like me a little bit better.
And of course, it's all about being liked.
Right, exactly.
Okay, yeah. What was the biggest surprise for you and the biggest challenge?
I think the language itself wasn't a big challenge because I was a French teacher.
You talk with your hands, come on.
Yeah, gosh, but that wasn't surprising. I don't know what was surprising. What was surprising for me was the attitude. They have an expression that Triestini say, which is non c'est pas, which is no matter what you ask them, they'll say no. And at first, that can be disconcerting.
Well, that's not very welcoming.
No, it's terrible. But at some point, I realized that if you ask them twice, the second time, they'll say yes. So I got over that one pretty quickly.
So
except
basically,
twice.
You went for the second question
every time. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's always going to be no at first. And I think that can be frustrating for people.
And the other thing about Trieste, which is amazing, is if you take a look at where you are, you're so close to Venice.
Exactly.
And not to mention Slovenia.
Yes, and we spend a lot of time in both. And in fact, my daughter, who's in, she's starting elementary, but she's been in preschool.
Has your daughter learned to ask the second question?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. She's very good at doing both. Well, saying no.
No, kids do that all the time. Ask mom, then ask dad.
Yeah, she's pretty good at that too, yeah. But she speaks Slovenian, and that's kind of special.
Wow.
So she goes to a school in Italy that's taught in Slovenian, so she speaks
She'll be trilingual?
Yeah, she is already. She's really amazing. So I feel like she's really lucky. You kind of give your kids something that... I learned languages, I was 17 when I learned French, and I learned Italian at 30, so I feel like she's pretty lucky.
And because of the positioning of the city, I mean, most people in America, first of all, don't really know Trieste unless you mention maybe it's close to Venice. They have no clue about Slovenia.
Right. For a long time, I had to say ex-Yugoslavia, and then people would say, oh, is there still a war there? Now I think people are starting to know where at least Croatia is because of Game of Thrones and things like that.
Oh,
so
you go to Dubrovnik, you can't escape it. It's Game of Thrones
everywhere.
Signs and everywhere, right?
Yeah, this last year I went, it was the first time I saw Americans there, and I realized why. It's because, there must be something in TV filmed here otherwise. And in fact, Game of Thrones tour, I told my mom, she's like, oh, I need to go to that. So I realized.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So now people, I think, are starting to get a culture of where we are.
Well, speaking of where you are, a girl from Wisconsin now living in Trieste. Now everybody you've ever known in your life is coming to visit you.
Yeah, they have over the years, which is nice. And so I love it. I love it when people come to visit.
Okay, so because you're the tour guide.
Yeah, I know where to, I give them the bus ticket. I give them the old cell phone. I set them on their way.
Oh, basically, have a nice tour. Here's the bus ticket. That's your idea of a tour?
Yeah, because it's, we got to make people autonomous. Actually, we've got a Trieste USA tour
that we
do through the association that
Tell
was
me.
Really popular. The sites were the things that the Americans did while they were here. But for my people, I've got my whole family coming in June for a reunion, and we're already planning that one, wine tastings and everything else.
Tough duty you have.
I know, it's tough.
Okay, when your American friends come to visit, what's the first thing that blows them away?
For some reason, people get really excited about coffee here. They get the cappuccino. You can have a really good cappuccino all day. It makes the Trieste like, what are they doing? Why are they having a cappuccino after dinner?
They're going through Starbucks withdrawal. Come on.
Yeah, it could be. In fact, the Triestini said, thank goodness there's Starbucks. So when we go to America, we can finally have a good cup of coffee.
That's what they're saying?
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
See, everybody's called coffee envy.
I know.
Unbelievable.
And we've got Il Caffè here, which is an important coffee brand. So Trieste is a coffee city. So I think that's one of the things that people appreciate. Also, the Carso blows people away when you have a Vitosca, which is a really famous white wine here that if you close your eyes, it tastes like a red wine. It's so rich. When people discover that, this was a grape that was going extinct and it was saved by families up in the Carso near Prepoto. I don't know if you've been there yet.
I have not.
Ziderich is our favorite wine from this area. And I think when people realize that there's amazing wine also here, they can't believe it. So beautiful places, beautiful views, awesome wine, great food. Oh, also the food is surprising for people because while there is you can always get the Italian food or things that we think of as Italian, but Trieste also has its main foods are ham and sauerkraut. And that's surprising.
But we're back to Wisconsin now.
Exactly.
You've come full circle.
I feel right at home.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
Joining me now, the project director and the coordinator for all this, who's got a big job because this is one big ship. His name is Nemo Lubrano. I got it, didn't I, Nemo?
Yes.
I did. So when you design a ship like this, you know, it's one thing to sit down at a dinner table and map it out on a napkin or come up with a concept. But then you're talking pages and pages and pages of drawings and concepts and design work. Because when you design a ship, it's all about the space, it's all about the functionality, it's all about the seaworthiness, it's all about the materials. You're going out there in salt water, right?
Yes, correct.
So what have you learned in incorporating into the design of the ship to make sure that all that works?
Yeah, so from the beginning we started from a concept. And we just wanted to highlight that Seaside project, it will be not like just any other cruise, of course, a new prototype and a vessel for everyone. So from the family.
So those are the orders you were given. Do this differently.
Yes, completely different project from the others and, of course, also from our competitors. And we focus especially, we call Seaside the ship that follows the sun. So the entire ship is fought for open space, for open air, and just to make our guests can enjoy the open space. That's why we have the one of the highest ratio compared to other, of course, cruise vessel. About the open air available space per guest.
But you also had to, once you're going to have all that open space, you have to come up with ideas about wind and weather and what happens if it's raining, what happens if it's too cold, right?
Yeah, of course, if it's rain, we have an available space, indoor space.
You have a sliding roof too? A sliding roof or no?
Yes, we have a macro dome.
Yeah.
That will cover one of the main pool of our vessels, and of course about the wind, such ships will be certified by our class register, that is RINA, for comfort class. That means that also during the navigation, so during the sailing of the ships, our guests are in a comfortable area, even if it is outside.
So no matter where you go, you'll be okay.
Sorry?
No matter where you go on the ship, you'll be okay.
Yes, for sure. For sure.
What other design factors? You know, when talking to Vago, he was saying to me, you know, well, you know, his mother-in-law wants this kind of material, and she wants this, and she wants that. You have to work with that too.
Yes, for sure. With our architects, we enjoyed these new vessels, and we featured every single space with the best materials, the best colors, the best shape, the best functionality, and so on.
Let's talk about color. Yeah. I'm sure that you've done enough study over the years to figure out what colors work and what colors don't. Is there a color you'll never put on a ship?
No, to be honest, I don't know. But I don't think that maybe any colors is...
No, because there are certain colors on an airplane, for example. They'll never put, like, you know, hospital green inside an airplane because mm-hmm. people get sick, right? Right? So I'm sure that in some areas you have to say, no, this color is just not going to work. We want another color.
It's we try, of course, to have a compromise.
Okay, so is there a material,
the colors, but
is there a material you won't use? Meaning there are certain materials that will work well. I'm not certain that leather is going to do outside very well. I mean, you have to figure out, you learn by experience what works and what doesn't.
Yes, for sure. From our histories, we learned a lot in terms of functionality of the materials.
Like what?
For example, marbles, carpet, and all the others, aluminum, stainless steel, and so on.
Okay, so what is what did you learn about marble? Where does it work and where does it not work?
We choose to fit the vessels. We choose, of course, the best marble, let me say.
So you're using a lot of marble?
We are using marble, yeah.
That's what I'm saying, right.
Yeah. We select from the cave, just let me say, the first block of this marble, and of course of the production will increase, will be increased on board on the vessels.
So marble's heavy, right?
Yeah.
But the weight doesn't matter that much on a ship this big, I suppose.
No, of course the weight is also, it was also important.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.